You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Hobb,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Andrew Grant.
Go to HankGarner.com. You can find archives of all the shows, and you can subscribe there so you never miss an episode. I want to thank our sponsors today who make this show possible, and not only do they make the show possible, but they are doing amazing things. I want you to go visit M.G. Herron and check out his brand new book called The Translocator. You can find it at mgherron.com/ASP, ASP for Author Stories Podcast. A revolutionary quantum teleportation device promises to bring humanity one step closer to the stars until it fails spectacularly. Archaeologist Eliana Fisk is ripped from Earth while the whole world watches. She lands on a strange new world inhabited by a lost tribe of ancient Mayans. Meeting them, getting first-hand exposure to age-old customs and rituals, it seems like an archaeologist's dream. But what if the rituals have a darker meaning? What if the god these people pray to is no god at all? And how in the world will she ever get back home? Thus begins a pulse-pounding race against time that hurls Eliana into the great unknown, revealing ancient technologies and marvelous mysteries more outlandish than she ever imagined. The Translocator is an action-packed sci-fi thriller perfect for fans of Stargate, The Atlantis Gene, and other archaeology-inspired science fiction adventures. mgherron.com/ASP. I'd also like to tell you about Robert Cruzy's series, Saga of the Iron Dragon. The first book, The Dream of the Iron Dragon, just blew my mind away. I love this book so much. The 23rd century humanity has been hunted to the verge of extinction by an alien race. Trapped 1,300 years in the past, they have one mission: survive. Space travel, Vikings, time travel. The first book is out. The second book is out. The audiobook releases in just a day or two when you're hearing this. And then the third book is out in ebook and paperback also later this week. I love the series so much. I think you guys are too. The Dream of the Iron Dragon, Dawn of the Iron Dragon, and now book three, The Voyage of the Iron Dragon. There's a link to it in the show notes. Robert Cruzy, Saga of the Iron Dragon.
Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Andrew Grant on the show with me today. When you are listening to this show, he has a brand new book out. It's called Invisible. I've had an early release copy of it. This book is fantastic, guys. If you are looking for a mystery thriller to kick off your 2019, this is the book to start with. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Hank. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you so much for those kind words about the book. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's an exceptional book. I'm really excited. I've read a couple of your previous books, and I'm excited to see that you're starting a new series. So yeah, lots of great stuff to talk about. But before we get into that, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, that's a really good question. It's hard to pin that down. What I would say is it took a long time before I really realized that I wanted to be a writer, but I've been fascinated with telling stories my whole life. You know, right back to when I was a little kid, I was constantly telling stories. And typically, if we were going on a long car journey, and given that I grew up in the UK, if it was a long car journey, it was normally due to congestion rather than how far you can go. But you know, I'd be driving along with my parents. It would be the days before you had seat belts in the back of the car, so I'd be standing there between the two back seats talking to them, sorry, the two front seats talking to them. And they you know, I'd always start off with something from real life, something that happened at grade school or with playing with my friends outside or something. And my parents later, years later, they let on that they knew that I was spinning off into story mode, because I'd always say, and then suddenly, and then launch into some, you know, crazy realm of fantasy. So right from being a little kid, I love telling stories. It served me well throughout school. You know, if my homework was late or I hadn't done an assignment, I could generally get myself out of trouble by just thinking up something crazy enough to use as an excuse. And you know, that really lasted through until when I was at college. I ended up doing a degree in English literature and drama, and the drama side of it just really grabbed me, because if it's my way of thinking, there's nothing more real about telling a story than in the theater, because you're not reading about it at third hand. You've got people standing right in front of you telling you the story and acting out the story. So I was really grabbed by theater, and after I finished my degree, I went on with some friends and we formed our own theater company, which we ran for a couple of years. So really, the storytelling that I loved, it was all about theater. But then, you know, after a little while, trying to run a small independent theater company that nobody's heard of, it's a lot of fun, and you know, you get a lot out of it artistically, but boy, do you end up broke. So I decided to do something about it. I thought I would get a real job for a change and try to repair the hole in my bank account. It was only supposed to be a temporary thing. So what I did, this was the days before the internet, you know, you couldn't Google to find jobs. So you had to wait until, in England, you'd wait until the Sunday Times came out and they had a supplement with all of the graduate jobs in it. So I looked and I applied this extremely scientific method to finding a job. What I did was I looked for the one with the highest starting salary. And I applied for that one. I mean, that was more a reflection of the hole in my bank account than anything else. So I applied for that and I was fortunate enough to get it. And it was a job in telecommunications, which was supposed to be this short-term fix to being broke, but it morphed into this kind of 15-year-long nightmare. So during the time that I had this job, I would be on the road a lot. So it made it really hard to go to the theater, because I was never sure whether I could commit to getting tickets. If I bought them, I'd inevitably miss the show. If I didn't buy them, it turned out I could have gone, and then it was too late. So just naturally, over the course of those years, I just read more and more and went to the theater less and less. And, you know, as you read, you know, in a way, writing is a sort of ultimate extension of reading. It's in a way, it's just a sort of more self-indulgent way of reading, because you get to decide what happens. And I think the thing that got me, that, you know, the day that the fatal itch that had to be scratched took hold, was I was reading a particular book. It was a thriller. It was fantastic. It started off magnificently. It was just amazing. You know, one of those books that, you know, you'd watch while your house burnt down, because you just had to read this book instead of making, you know, call it.
Right.
But when I got to the end, it was terrible. And I caught myself thinking, well, why did he do it like that? Why didn't he have this happen? Why didn't he have that happen? Why didn't this character do this thing? And then, you know, from that moment, I was hooked. It was from then on, I knew at some point that I was going to have to start at least trying to write books for myself. Had no idea whether it would work, but, you know, I got caught up in that. Well, I got caught up by two cliches. I'm a massive lover of cliches. And one of them is, you know, better to have loved and lost than never loved at all. So, you know, convert that into write and lost. But, you know, I thought at least I'll try it. And the other thing was, I heard somebody say once that the saddest words in the English language are "what if," and I thought, I do not want to get to the end of my career and be ready to retire and look back and say, well, what if I tried writing instead? You know, I thought, I've at least got to try it and see if I can do it. So, you know, fortunately, so far I'm hanging in. So you know, I'm very glad I made that decision.
I'm a huge lover of these kind of sappy cliches as well, and the what if thing has propelled me in so many directions that I never thought my life would take me. But I feel the same way, that the worst thing ever would be to end up at the end of your life and think of all of the wasted opportunities or just things that you never tried. I completely understand that line of thinking. The yeah. I've I've interviewed a lot of authors, and they're usually, I believe that the storytelling gene is there in people, and sometimes theater is a great expression of that, and for a lot of people, it is, and there's definitely this symbiosis. There's a connection between theater actors, writers, directors, and fiction writers. There's a lot of frustrated actors that then go on to write fiction, I think, or frustrated directors. Writing fiction seems to be a great outlet for that, maybe because the writer has complete control, and maybe that's one aspect. But there are usually one of two situations that motivate people to act on that desire to write. And sometimes it's reading a book and being completely motivated by that book, that you're kind of bitten by the bug and you're just so excited for how the story is, you want to do it yourself. And the other side of the coin is that, oh my gosh, I could do better than this. And it sounds like you had a bit of both, that you're really excited by this book, but the ending really let you down. It's a crazy thing to think, I'm holding this published book in my hand and I think I can do better than this. How long was it before you started working on your own story after that moment of?
It wasn't very long. I started pretty much straight away, but it took quite a long time from there to being able to do it for a living, because what I originally thought, I decided, well, the smart thing to do, because when you write your first book, if it's fiction, you nearly always have to do what they call write it on spec. You know, you have to finish the book, sure, and then try to sell it. So I thought, you know, that's a risky business if you don't have any other income, if you're just writing this book and not getting paid for it and may never get paid for it. So I thought the smart thing to do will be to try to do the two things in parallel, keep going with my day job and write what's going to be my first book in my spare time. But the problem was, much as I tried, I just couldn't make any progress, because I'd start to build up some momentum with the book. Then I'd get sent away on some, you know, work thing for a week. And by the time I came back, I'd have forgotten where I was, what the characters were doing, why they, you know. And I was getting nowhere. I was just spinning my wheels. So I really had to pick between the two. You know, do I just focus entirely back on the day job, or do I really commit to trying to be a writer? So in the end, I decided I'm going to commit. And the only snag that I had was that the company I worked for was going through a program of it was letting a lot of people go, and it was paying severance packages to a lot of these people. So I thought, this is genius. You can either get paid to work or you can get paid not to work. So, you know, I want option B. But the snag was the part of the company I worked in, as luck would have it, I was in the one division that wasn't offering severance packages, because that one division was doing okay at the time. So I tried everything. I tried to get transferred to another division, but they wouldn't let you go to one that where you could get a severance package. If you wanted to leave, you just had to walk away, which I didn't want to do. So it took a while. And actually, funnily enough, it was one of the most successful periods in my career, because I thought, what I'll do is I'll make such a nuisance of myself that these guys get so sick of me that they just think it's going to be easy just to give him some money and let him leave. So every time the top management came, if there was some problem they wanted to discuss, I just came up with the most ridiculous ideas I could think of, the stupidest suggestions, the craziest schemes. And the thing was, these management guys loved it. They lapped it up, and I got promoted. I got more money for about 18 months. I was a superstar. And then, unfortunately, you know, probably due to all of these stupid ideas I was having, that division also started struggling. And then pretty soon the severance packages became available. So I was able to get one. And what I figured was that would give me about 12 months worth of money that I could use as a cushion while I wrote the first book. So that was the sort of stepping stone that I used from the one world to the next.
Wow. So what was that first book that you wrote? And the first one did you that you wrote, did that book get published?
It did, yeah. The first one that I wrote was Even, it was called. I guess, you know, publishing, the wheels move relatively slow. So I guess what happened was I left that job in the end of June 2006, and I figured I would have a year or so's worth of money, but I managed to squeeze it out a little longer because I did get the book written within the first year. So by, how did it go? By, I guess, so I finished the book in roughly June or July 2007, got an agent in, I think, December 07. We managed to get a deal for the book in about February 08, and then it actually hit the shelves in May 09, because, you know, everything is much more drawn out in publishing. I was used to the telecommunications world, so when I got the contract offer in February 08 and they were talking about May, I was thinking, oh, well, obviously May 08 then, and that's quite slow, isn't it? And then they were saying, no, 09.
I can imagine the dread that sets in, and oh god, it's another year.
Exactly. But then, you know, in a way it was a good thing, because everybody talks about the difference in how it feels to write your first book compared to every other book you write, especially the second one, because the first one, the time scale is entirely up to you. You can take as long as you want writing your first book. One of my friends, I think she said she took 14 years writing that first book. But the trouble is, you get a contract and they say, well, this is great, we want the next one in 12 months. And that can be a huge change, because all of a sudden you've got less time. Even if you don't have less time, even if you did write the first one within a year, it's still different if you've got the feeling of someone hovering over you with a stopwatch saying, you know, you've got to have it done by this deadline. And, you know, it messes with your head, because when you're writing your first one, you're saying to yourself, well, I don't really know if this will work or not, but I'll give it a shot. But by the time that you've actually got a contract, you're thinking, wow, I'm supposed to be a professional now. How does one of those work? You know, you've got no idea. And, if you're in a sales job, for example, like I was in for many years, you know, you have, depends on the job, but you're going to have weekly or monthly or quarterly or, you know, targets. So it's pretty easy to keep a check of whether you're on the right path or not. But if they say to you, okay, write a book, hand it in a year, see you later, you know, it's actually very hard to know if you are doing it right or not, because, you know, there's no yardstick to measure it against.
Well, you know, that first book is, it's really a gift in that, you're not under that stopwatch like you talked about. There's a lot of times you're the only person in the world that knows that you're writing a book, or, you know, a significant other or a close friend or something sometimes. But that anonymity is a real gift, because that's when you're learning to do the whole thing, and you don't really know anything about it until you start doing it. You can take a class on writing, but until you sit down and actually start structuring a narrative and putting plot points together and characters, it's all new territory. When you start writing the second book, what do you feel like that you learned from the first book experience that helped the second book?
Well, it's a good question. And you know, you definitely do learn as you go along, not as much or as quickly as I would have liked. But, you know, it took more than just one book. But I have learned that if certain things happen to me while I'm writing, there's generally a reason for it. And one of these, it kind of links to what people often talk about as writer's block. You know, when you sit down and you try to write and you just can't put a word on the page. And one thing happened to me when I was writing my first book that came in very useful for the second one and onwards, which was that I was getting ready to write a scene. It's really nice if you finish one day knowing what you're going to do the next, you know, because the blank page is very intimidating. So if you know what you're going to do, it's great. And not only did I know what I was going to do, but I knew that it was going to be a scene with loads of dialogue in. And, you know, from my theater days, I love those scenes. They're my favorite. So I was really excited to start. But to my absolute horror. I couldn't do it. I couldn't write a single word, and I just couldn't understand it. I couldn't understand what was wrong with me. And I strained and struggled and got really mad and frustrated. And in the end, after hours of doing this, I just thought, right, forget it. It's just not happening. I'll just go and make a cup of coffee. So when I wasn't thinking about it deliberately, the explanation pinged into the back of my head. It was that this scene of dialogue was supposed to take place on the phone. The hero was going to be calling someone on his cell phone. And 2 or 3 days earlier, I'd written a scene where there was like an action scene with some fighting, and he'd lost his cell phone. So it was impossible for that scene to take place the way I was conceiving it, because he didn't have a phone to make the phone call on. So that penny dropped. I just, you know, had a very quick bit of explanation about him getting another phone, and then it started to flow again. So what I've realized is, if I find myself in that position where for some reason I can't write a single word, rather than to get mad with myself about it, I try to say, okay, it's probably just this subconscious safety net kicking in and saying, you're about to go down the wrong route here, you know, so stop, look back, there's a mistake, you've just got to find it. And that's bailed me out of trouble several times since then. And I guess that's probably the most useful lesson I learned doing that first book.
You talked about reading that thriller book that motivated you to try your hand at it. Had you been a fan of the genre before that? Have you been a lifelong student of mysteries, thrillers, or is this something that you just became fascinated with?
Yeah, I mean, looking back, I think I always have. I mean, I read a lot of stuff. I read all kinds of different genres. So I wouldn't say that I'm the sort of person that sticks exclusively to the genre. But as during those years when I was working for that phone company and I was on the road a lot and reading in the hotels in the evenings, without kind of consciously realizing, when I look back, I thought, oh, actually, there's a pattern here. You know, I'm reading the kind of Cold War spy novels, the kind of action thrillers, and then, you know, as the years went by, you know, there were more sort of subdivisions in the genre. You know, you got more of the police procedurals came in. You got the psychological thrillers, you know, started by Thomas Harris and people like that. So, you know, I realized that without ever intentionally saying, oh, I want to just read lots of thrillers, I realized that I had done. But I think the first that you could tie loosely to the genre, and still to this day one of my all-time favorite books, it came about, bizarrely enough, I was 10 years old. I was in what we call in England primary school, and we had a teacher who wasn't all that keen on teaching. He would generally just tell us, he would give us 5 minutes of mental arithmetic in the morning, and then we were supposed to work on various projects that he would set while he sat at his desk and read the newspaper. So when this particular school year, I did the first project that he set, and he wouldn't mark it. It was in the 1970s, and they had this thing about marking work being elitist, because if you didn't do very well, then you might feel bad. So they better not mark anything, so as to spare the, you know, people's feelings. So I just thought, well, wait a minute, I did the work writing this thing, so if I put in the effort, you can put in the effort, and if you're not going to, I'm not going to. So from that point, I didn't do any more of these projects. I just brought books in from home and, you know, smuggled them in and read them under the desk. And one day, you know, I was reading this, I remember it clearly, I was reading a book called Watership Down, if you know that one.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And it was just brilliant. And evidently it was too good, because I was too absorbed in it to notice the teacher making one of his kind of rare forays out from behind his desk. And he came around and he caught me reading it. And he sort of dragged it out from under the desk where I was hiding it and held it up. And he was saying, you're reading this. You think you're a good reader because you can read this. Well, you should. And I remember his words. He said, unless you can go to any bookshelf and pick up any book and read it without thinking, you can't call yourself a good reader. So I thought to myself, first of all, what's this idea of reading without thinking? That's weird. But then more than that, you know, even when I was a kid, and, you know, still to this day, if I perceive something as a challenge, my first instinct is, right, well, we'll see about that. So that night I went home, went to my dad's bookshelf. He had quite a good collection of books. And I thought, okay, I've got to pick any one of these and see if I can read it. And I was a little nervous at this point, because I was thinking, well, what if I can't? you know, what if the teacher was right? So at random, I picked a book, and it was Ice Station Zebra by Alasdair MacLean. And, you know, I thought, this is fantastic. I've lucked out here because it's about a station on the ice where they have zebras. This is going to be fantastic, you know. And at this, you know, this was such a step from anything I'd read before, you know, the idea that you have an unreliable narrator who's just lying to you right and left. And, you know, everybody is tricking everybody else. You can't believe anything you read. You've got to work it out for yourself. You know, all this cool, I mean, it's kind of old hat now, but, you know, cool gadgetry like nuclear submarines and satellites. And, oh, I just, it, you know, it was I don't think the guy meant it in this way, but he absolutely transformed my life that day by throwing down that gauntlet. And, so, and actually years later, my wife Tasha, who's also a novelist, she, I told her that story. So she actually found a first edition hardcover of Ice Station Zebra for me. So we got that in pride of place on my shelves at home.
Wow, she's a keeper. That's a fantastic gift.
Oh, it is.
Oh, man. So you're coming up on your 10th year of publishing then, this being, when people are hearing this is 2019 now, your first book came out in 2009.
Exactly. And that makes me kind of nervous because, you know, the old cliche that it takes 10 years to become an overnight success. So.
Right, exactly.
Up to this point, I've had an excuse. I could say, well, it's only been 9 years, you know, but, you know.
Well, after reading this book, if any book will make you an overnight success, air quotes that I'm doing here, this is the book to do it for sure. It's a fantastic read. How do you feel that the genre or the publishing in the genre has changed over the last decade? It seems to me, I'm trying to remember what books were big and popular at the time, but there are a lot of Cold War thrillers, like spy thrillers that you were talking about. And the last couple of years, there's been a really big surge in psychological thrillers and protagonists that are, you know, maybe on the darker side of the scale. A lot of I'm trying to really grasp the word that I'm looking for here, but there's been a subtle shift in kind of the kinds of books that are coming out and the kinds of books that readers are really gravitating to. In your work and what you see in the industry, how do you feel like the thriller genre has changed and matured over the decade that you've been in it?
Well, that's a fantastic question. I guess what I'd say is that I would see the thriller as an entity operating kind of on two levels, and within the market, on one level, I think things haven't changed much, which is that if you strip away the detail and just look at the principle of what they do, I think thrillers are all about providing an element of escapism for people who have frustrating everyday lives on a micro level at work or with their family, on a macro level with the world they live in, you know, whatever the current problem is, whether it's the Cold War, whether it's terrorism, whether it's the state of politics, whatever it might be. You know, people have these things in their lives that are kind of, you know, bearing down on them like dark, wet blankets. So one thing the thriller does is it enables you to crawl out from under there into a much nicer a place that, even though it mirrors some of the horrible details, ultimately right prevails over wrong, even if it's just on the pages of a book rather than in real life. You know, you can start to live in a world where even if rules get broken, even if not everything is quite right and there's a bit of broken glass to sweep up at the end of it, essentially the good guys win, the bad guys lose. So I think in principle, thrillers have stayed the same. They've stayed on that path. I think the difference is thrillers sort of have to be rooted in today in order to, you know, rooted in real life in order to then give you a jumping off point into this escapism. And the thing that roots our everyday lives has changed somewhat over the last decade. You know, you mentioned the Cold War, that was coming to an end, so it was no longer quite the fertile bank of material that it had been. You then morphed into the kind of terrorism, you know, the war on terror, ISIS, all of these guys for a while. And then, as you say, it almost became more personal with the psychological side, you know, the more, you know, the not knowing who you can trust in your own family, in your own circle of friends and so on. So, you know, the detail part, the part that gives you that jumping off point has changed definitely.
Right. And the more personal focus on the thriller is exactly what I was hoping that you were going to bring us to, because your new book Invisible, we meet Paul McGrath, is the focus of the story. Tell us about Paul. Where did he come from for you? And tell us where we find him in the beginning of the story.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I've had such a blast writing about Paul McGrath. And where he came from really was, in some ways, it was a reflection on what I was writing previously. My last three books had featured a police detective in Birmingham, Alabama, and I really enjoyed writing those books. And I think that the character had some really interesting aspects to him. But the thing was that as a police detective, the kind of things he was going to be involved with and the kind of ways that he approach them were somewhat set. So it struck me that over the last few years there's been a bit of a shift in society. You know, it felt to me like it was time for a new kind of hero, you know, a kind of hero who stood up for the little guy much more than had been done before. You know, we're in a time where you can have a corporate banker who steals billions of dollars, who gets away with a slap on the wrist, and you get a guy who cheats on his social security and he's in jail for the rest of his life, you know. So I felt that there's some really interesting moral considerations there, because what can be legal isn't necessarily the same as what can be right. So that was the sort of original, you know, concept for coming up with Paul McGrath's character. And what I ended up doing was deciding that that it would be really fascinating to have a guy who had a sort of fly-on-the-wall view of the legal system as it operated. So he would see when a case went south because there was a misstep in the procedure, or some evidence was tainted, or a juror changed their view, or a witness changed their testimony. Things that, if you were simply looking at it in terms of has the legal procedure been followed, nothing was done wrong. But if you take a step back and look at it in a more kind of human context and say, well, is it right that this guy was punished, or was it right that this guy wasn't punished? You know, that's a whole different aspect. And I think if you go back to what I was saying about thrillers playing this role of providing a very kind of satisfying world in which you see somebody come in and put wrongs right, I thought there was an opportunity there for a new hero to do that. So the idea with Paul McGrath is that Paul grew up not knowing his mother, because she died when he was very young. He was raised by his father, but his father was a very successful businessman, but also a passionate pacifist. So he wanted Paul to join him in the family business. So Paul, as a teenager, his way of rebelling against his pacifist businessman father was to join the army. And he became an extremely successful military intelligence operative. And in fact, Invisible opens with a scene. It actually turns out to be Paul's last mission in the army. He's in Istanbul, Turkey, doing something to involving some Iranian military and some nuclear secrets. So he's off on his final mission, and he's very, very successful, but it's nagged at him that he left things in such a bad way with his father. So his tour of duty comes to an end. He goes back to New York to put things right with his father, and finds that his father not only is dead, but died under mysterious circumstances. And the person who the police thought were responsible got away his trial ended up in a mistrial due to some evidence disappearing. So Paul decides to go undercover to find out what happened to his father. And, you know, he has this arsenal of skills from his time in military intelligence. So he decides that the answers must lie somewhere in the courthouse. So he gets a job there as a janitor, because as a janitor, he can go anywhere. He can look at anything. He sees everybody, but no one notices him because he's just the guy in the corner with the mop and the bucket. So I thought the very job that he has is a great metaphor for what he's going to be doing, which is the guy that nobody sees, but who sees everything and who stands up for the little guy and sweeps up the mess when things fall through the cracks in the system.
Well, the idea that in the world that we live in today, where legality and morality are not always the same thing, and you kind of alluded to that earlier, you know, the things that people can get away with are not necessarily right, and the idea that we want someone who can come in and bring true justice, I think that resonates with all of us, and that's kind of the reason that we resonate with characters, you know, like a Jack Reacher is, you know, we have this idea of someone who comes in and cleans things up, but the difference in a character like Reacher and Paul McGrath is that we get to emotionally care about Paul McGrath and his journey that we don't get to with a Jack Reacher, who's just kind of a wandering drifter, that we never get to the core of who he is. And that's one thing I love about this book is that immediately you give us something to hold on to, where McGrath is not just the guy that comes in and cleans up town and then goes to the next one, the wandering drifter. He kind of becomes one of us. And I think that helps us to care more about this character and his journey and his search for justice.
Well, thank you. That's exactly what I was hoping for. And, you know, because he is on the trail of, because he's trying to uncover what happened in his father's case, it's essential for him that no one knows that it's him that's doing these things. You know, so he sees something that's unjust happening to somebody around him, and he steps in and does something about it. He's not doing it for glory. He's not doing it for a reward. He's not doing it for a pat on the back, even. He must remain anonymous at all times. So I think that adds an extra little twist to it too, because, you know, you see something, it's as if he is one of us, but it's also as if one of us could be him, you know?
Exactly. This is being promoted as the first book in a new series, without giving away what happens in the end of this book. Did you realize this character had potential to continue the story and the adventures that he's on when you first conceived of the story?
Well, I certainly hoped that he had. You know, my goal was to come up with a hero that would resonate with people and that they wanted to read more about. And that's really largely because, as a reader, you know, all writers are readers first and foremost, and sure. I love nothing more than reading a series. And so I would really love to create a long-running series for that exact reason, and I'm hoping that that Paul McGrath will you know, the character that he is and the setup that he's in will give me the potential to do that. So, but really, that's down to you guys, because if no one buys the book, then they won't let me turn it into a series.
Well, it's really such a unique concept. I really, you know, when I read the blurb, I was like, wow, I wonder how he's going to make this work. And it is such a natural character progression that we go on with McGrath, that the situations he finds himself in, the day job, the cover that he has, it's not just plot points that you said, oh, this would be neat if he could do this. It is such a natural growth for the character. You know, and when you're first envisioning a character like him, and you're kind of building his world and who he is, you know, what I guess what I'm asking is, how do you come up with character growth that seems so natural and it doesn't just seem like you're taking this character and forcing him mm-hmm. into places that would make the storytelling easier. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does, yeah, and that's absolutely one of the hardest things to do. And I think you've got to trust your judgment, and you've got to trust your editor's judgment, and you've got to provide enough detail, well, enough that that people will believe that the character would go on the journey that he's gone on, and would do the things that he's done. You know, and actually, it turned out from the initial concept to the final book that I found that a lot more of that development was needed than I'd originally anticipated, because I have a sort of a mental test, which is if you're reading a sequence in a crime thriller or any kind of thriller, if you could say to you, if the question pops into your head, well, why didn't he just call the police? You know, that's a red flag for me. That's where you'd potentially stop reading, because it's no longer convincing you. It was a fantastic example of this. It was done in a comic way. I don't know if you ever, there were two, I think there might be a third one coming out called Johnny English with Rowan Atkinson, sort of lampooning the James Bond type movies. In Johnny English 2, there was a scene where they're in Hong Kong or somewhere. There's a fight taking place on the roof of a skyscraper, as there always is in these type movies. And the bad guy gets away, and he starts climbing down this intricate network of bamboo scaffolding that's been built up the side of the building. You know, incredibly dangerous, pieces of falling on, you know. So, and what they do in a normal movie, then the hero would start down after the other guy and chase him down this dangerous bamboo scaffolding. But in Johnny English 2, what he does is he looks over, he sees the guy scrambling on the scaffolding, so he just strolls across to the elevator, gets in, hits the button for ground, rides down nice and calm, pops out just in time to grab the guy as he reaches the ground, you know. And that is a beautiful visual example of, if you're writing a book and there's some much easier, much safer, much more logical thing for the hero to do, why wouldn't he have done it? So you have to construct it in such a way that the reader will believe in the choices and the decisions. And they can be emotional, you know, they can be emotionally driven. It could just be that someone's at the end of their tether and does something stupid anyway, even though, you know, but you have to believe that that person in that situation would do it. So what I ended up doing was putting in a lot more time and effort on the parts in the book where you see Paul moving from his life in the military to his new civilian life. You know, there are examples where he comes across things that he can see are wrong or suspects are wrong. So he has a contact at the police. So he goes and he reports all of these things, you know, like you're supposed to do. And, you know, perhaps almost in a sort of naive way, because he's been in the army ever since he was 18, he's never really lived as a civilian adult at all in his whole life. You know, he almost as a, you know, sort of childlike way thinks, well, you know, you see something wrong, you tell the police, they take care of it. And it turns out, well, actually, they're not going to take care of it, because these are detectives. They have specific cases to investigate. They're not interested in this nonsense that this weird guy who's just out of the army is bringing to them. So gradually it gets to the point where, and there's a particular episode that I don't want to go into too much detail about, that takes place at the courthouse, that really leads him to believe, well, okay, in this new world, clearly, if there's a problem and you want it taken care of, you've just got to take care of it yourself. So you don't see him leaping, you know, straight from one world to the other. There's a process that I did work very hard on to try to show him developing from one state to the next state. So, you know, it's fabulous. Thank you for your kind words that struck you as well.
Yeah. Well, Andrew, I absolutely love this book. I love the character of Paul McGrath. He's a complicated, complex character. But what I love about it is he's a vigilante that feels like he could be a friend of mine, that is someone that we want to root for, and not just someone who's handling the dirty business and we look the other way because maybe he's doing the right thing for the wrong reasons. McGrath is a vigilante we can care about and we can get on his side. And that's one thing I love about this book. And it's a fantastic, fascinating, you know, white knuckle read. So I absolutely love it. Invisible is out everywhere now in hardback and an audiobook for when folks are listening to this. Andrew, if people are just learning about you and your work, is there a place online where they can connect with you and maybe dig into your back catalog and find out all about you?
Absolutely, yeah. I have a website, which is andrewgrantbooks.com. One problem with having a common name like Andrew Grant is it's hard to get a good website, so it's andrewgrantbooks.com. You can also find me on Facebook, as I think I'm Andrew Grant Author, and on Twitter as Andrew_Grant.
Excellent. Excellent. Andrew, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today. We're going to put links to everything in the show notes and send everyone to pick up their copy of Invisible. Andrew, thank you for taking time to come on with me today.
Well, thank you, Hank. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories podcast. You can find archives of all of the shows at hankgarner.com. And when you're there, please subscribe. Up next is an audiobook clip from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
"I'm melting! I'm melting!" cried Joey. "Take the picture already!" He stood with one arm around the bronze waist of the bewitched tribute statue, Samantha Stevens, riding a broom across a crescent moon. Jason tried in vain to frame the shot without any tourists in it, but that was impossible. From all points of the compass, a merry horde had arrived for Salem's two-day summer psychic fair. All the commuter trains had burst open, like cornucopias filled beyond capacity, spilling endless fruits and nuts onto the red brick sidewalks of Essex Street. A vampirist in lavender shorts and feathered boots sold maple chocolate walnut fudge in front of the Witch City Tattoo Parlor. A near-naked gypsy in purple-green veils danced with a pheasant in her arms around a plug-in Hanukkah menorah. A fat man in a fetching blue jeans dress sold amethyst and citrine charm bracelets in front of Medusa Cafe, but his stand got knocked over by a one-armed crone driving a mobility scooter who sang choo-choo as she passed, her stump on the wheel, her lipstick ghastly, her gnarled right hand raised in trailing plumes of noxious cigarette smoke. Chewbacca leapt out of her way and slapped sparks from his fur. He gave a disgruntled growl before going back to playing Summer Lovin' on his ukulele. The old one-armed dervish drove off, choo-choo, parting a crowd of wanderers, slack-jawed tourists with camera straps tight across their bellies, yellow-vested police on segways, elderly rollerbladers, face-painted infants and harried parents, and college girls. So many hot, hysterical college girls that you'd think somebody had napalmed a sorority house.
"Jason, are you deaf?"
"Sorry." Jason raised the phone and took the shot. Joey inspected the photo and nodded in approval.
"Your turn."
"No, thanks."
"Do it, Shaggy. Don't make me hex you."
Jason gave in and traded places. He put an arm around Samantha's metal back. Her bronze body had flushed in the afternoon sun, warm through his glove, but her eyes were weary. No, downright creepy. And her smile was forced, like a Disneyland princess who'd had her toe stomped.
"Say chowder,"
cried Joey, who'd been practicing his New England accent all morning.
"Come on, man. Say chowder."
"Fine, chowder." Joey got the shot, and Jason surrendered Samantha to a chubby kid wearing a Gandalf beard who climbed up to worship her bronze bosom.